Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Eric Siegel, chair of the club's Personal Growth Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker is Dr. Matthew Fox, an Episcopal priest who was formerly a member of the Dominican Order. He has a doctorate in spiritual theology from the Institut Catholique de Paris and has been called the most read theologian in North America, with 33 books published, among which are Original Blessing, The Reinvention of Work, A Spirituality Named Compassion, A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality Journey, and Meister Eckhart, A Mystic Warrior for Our Time. His books have been translated into 60 languages and sold more than 1.5 million copies worldwide. Dr. Fox developed the concept of creation spirituality, which embodies the ongoing rapid shift from formal religion towards a broader-based, gender-neutral path that includes Eastern spirituality, the wisdom tradition in the Hebrew Bible, respect for the earth and native traditions, and dialogue with science and spirituality, including awe about nature and creation. He will be discussing creation spirituality with us, along with some other traditions and the relevant works of the Roman Catholic theologians and mystics Thomas Merton, Hildegard of Bingen, and Meister Eckhart. And if we have time, he'll also lead us in a meditation chant. This promises to be a fascinating hour about the intersection of spirituality and religion, so it is now my pleasure to ask you to join me in welcoming to the Commonwealth Club of California our speaker, Dr. Matthew Fox.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you for carrying on this topic of spirituality. I was here a few months ago to hear Lama Somo speak about Buddhist meditation, and that's when Eric and I struck up a conversation. And I think it's really important that this dimension that we call spirituality begin to penetrate more fully our cultural lives, including our professions, our work, our citizenship, our parenting and grandparenting, and of course our own survival as individuals in the kind of tense times in which we find ourselves. Eric suggested that I lead a meditation. I'm happy to do that. So I'm going to recommend that we put our feet on the floor so that the breath can flow freely. And remember, the word breath and spirit are the same in the biblical languages, but in many languages around the world. Several African languages have the same word for breath, spirit, and dance, which makes a lot of sense, too. Kind of hard to dance without breath, and dance is a great way to bring spirit in. So what I'm going to do is an ecumenical kind of meditation. We're going to play with the word, the sound ah. And I'm going to invite you to start making the sound ah. We'll get that rolling. And then I'm going to throw out divine names from around the world, all of which have this ah sound in it. I think it's more than coincidence that traditions around the world celebrate this sound ah. So let's do that together. Let's begin with the ah sound, and then I ask you to echo back the names that I throw out, okay? Ah, that's a breath. Ah, Buddha, 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 Brahmin, 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 Tara, 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 Krishna, 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 Hokma, 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 Sophia, 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 Yahweh, 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 Adonai, 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 Allah, 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 Gaia, 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 Wankantanka, 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 Tagashala, 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 Abba, 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 Amen. Thank you. So part of creation spirituality is the dimension of interfaith, what I call deep ecumenism. Just as the astronauts, when they left the Earth, looked back and did not see nations demarcated on the Earth, so they did not see religions demarcated on the Earth. As I wrote in my book, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ, 28 years ago, there's no such thing as a Buddhist river in a Christian cornfield and an atheist mountain or a Lutheran sun or a Baptist moon. That when religions get back to out of their anthropocentrism and get back to the sacredness of creation itself, religions themselves will become more humble and will realize that no one has all the answers and we all have problems. And, of course, the ecological crisis today and the climate crisis is a reminder of that in spades. And this is one reason why we have to go deeper than religion and to what we call spirituality. Spirituality is more the essence of our religions. When you do away with all the outer stuff, what's left? The great African-American mystic Howard Thurman, who was such a profound influence on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., that every time he went to jail, King brought one book with him, Howard Thurman's book, Jesus and the Disinherited. Howard Thurman used to say that we need to be stripped to our literal substance of ourselves before God. That was a phrase he used often. That, to me, is a working definition of spirituality. It's getting to the heart of the heart, the life within the life, the joy within the joy, the compassion within the compassion. That's getting at the heart of things. And this is why there's a growing movement today to say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. A lot of young people are saying this. In fact, this is the, when you look at it in terms of polls and statistics, this is the fastest growing population in America, but in many other places too. I just returned from lecturing in Italy. And even in Italy, which is very theocratic culture in many ways, people are asking to talk about the history and spirituality and religion. By people, I mean ordinary citizens, some of whom are practicing Catholics, some of whom are no longer, and clergy too. I met with a number of clergy who were themselves making this distinction. I think that we're living in an obvious time as a species. It's a shakedown time. Our time is running out as a species, and we can't afford all the trappings external trappings of our religious inheritances, as rich as they are. We have to get down to what makes us courageous, what gives us vision, what gives us inspiration, and how we can link up with others who may be different from ourselves. But we've got to start working on saving the planet. That comes first. I remember when I was a very young man in college, I was going to college in Dubuque, Iowa, and the Mississippi River was overflowing. And I remember, this would have been around 1958 or so, I remember we all gathered, like, all the seminaries and all the colleges, we all gathered down at the river to set up sandbags and the rest. And I remember literally rubbing shoulders with Jewish people and Protestant seminarians and lay people. It was just a mix. You know, when things are in crisis, you don't ask one another about your external affiliations. You're there either to contribute or not. And I think that's where we're at. It's all hands on deck at this time in history. And so I think that's the main reason why formal religion, institutional religion, is of less consequence today than spirituality. Spirituality is about the practice, the experience. It's the experiential side of religion. It's the experience of God. It's like the Pachama says, taste and see that God is good. You can't have vicarious tasting. And it's interesting, the word taste in both Hebrew and Latin is the basis of the word wisdom. So I think part of what we need to shift to as a species today is from knowledge to wisdom. And wisdom is not anti-intellectual or anti-knowledge, but it incorporates knowledge with the heart, because the heart has its own knowledge. And indeed, all the chakras have their own knowledge. Sexuality has its knowledge. Our first chakra, the linking to the earth, has its knowledge. And I think we have to broaden our understanding. The modern age defined truth in a very narrow way, and defined education in a very narrow way. As Descartes said, truth is clear and distinct ideas. Well, that takes truth out of your gut, out of your heart, out of your sexuality, and puts it all up in the head, and only one side of the head, the left brain of the head. In contrast, Einstein said that we've been given two gifts, the sacred gift of intuition, which is our right hemisphere of our brain, the mystical brain, and the gift of rationality, our intellectual brain. And he said, the second gift is meant to serve the first. But we live in a society, he said, that honors the second and ignores the first gift, the sacred gift. So a lot of spirituality is about triggering our intuition, about nurturing our intuition. And Einstein said, this is where values are born, in intuition, not in the intellect, he said. Do not overvalue the intellect. I love quoting Einstein on this, because you can't accuse Einstein of being anti-intellectual. But he says that the values do not come from the intellect. He says intellect gives us methods. It does not give us values. So spirituality is about training the right hemisphere of the brain. And with it, the heart, which, of course, is connected, is on the left side of the body, so it's connected to the right side of the brain, and all that follows. Let me share with you a wonderful poem. This is my most recent book, A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spirituality. How many of you know Thomas Merton? I've heard of his work or read some of it. He was an amazing religious figure. He died in 1968, and he was a Trappist monk, which is a very strict order. But he could really write, and his writings today, I think, are even more relevant today than when he wrote in the 60s. And it was Meister Eckhart who really woke Merton up. After 18 years in the monastery, Merton was rather dualistic and carrying the guilt and the shame of the Augustinian fall redemption tradition, patriarchal tradition, and dualistic tradition of Christianity. But he ran into Dr. Suzuki, the great Zen thinker who brought Zen to North America, the Japanese philosopher. And Suzuki said, read your one Zen thinker of the West, Meister Eckhart. And Merton said, well, he's been condemned by the church. And Suzuki said, well, I can't help that, can I? So Merton thought it over, and he spent a lot of time with Eckhart. And Eckhart converted Merton from being this dualistic, guilt-ridden monk to being an engaged, prophetic human being. From 1958 to his death in 1968, Merton flipped. And all of his writings were on Eastern religion, on Buddhism, on Taoism, and so forth, and on prophetic issues, cultural issues, such as the Vietnam War. He was the first figure to come out, religious figure to come out against the Vietnam War. He beat King to it. And in fact, the occasion when King marched in Memphis and met his death, he had been scheduled to do a retreat with Thomas Merton and Thich Nhat Hanh at Merton's monastery. At the last minute, he canceled it to march with the garbage collectors, and of course, that was his final act. It's very interesting the connections that Merton had in the 1960s. And here's one poem that I think is wonderful, Merton, and it speaks to the passion of the mystic. Merton had a mystical experience at one time during rush hour at lunchtime in Louisville. His monastery was near Louisville, and he snuck out as often as he could. He would often go to the black clubs, and they were very segregated back then. He would go there to hear jazz, and he loved jazz. And to this day, they're interviewing these 80-year-old black men who were young men back in the 60s, about this odd white guy who showed up. All he wanted to talk about, they say, was Zen Buddhism and meditation. And he'd sit in the back and listen to jazz. That was Thomas Merton. But here is his poem called First Lesson About Man. Man begins in zoology. I think that is his affirmation of evolution. Man begins in zoology. He is the saddest animal. He drives a big red car called anxiety. Whenever he goes to the phone to call joy, he gets the wrong number. Therefore, he likes weapons. He knows all guns by their right names. He drives a big black Cadillac called death. Now he's put anxiety into space. He flies his worries all around Venus, but it does him no good. Man is the saddest animal. He begins in zoology and gets lost in his own bad news. To me, that's vintage Merton. It's funny. It's full of images. It's clear. You get it. But it's very substantive. It's very profound, the topics he's raising there, including the whole topic of technology. Says we're flying around Venus, but we're just carrying our worries there. In the 1960s, the big gee whiz technological thing was, of course, getting to the moon. And Merton resisted this. He said, even ants can fly. What good is it going to be for us to sail to the moon if we do not deal with the fundamental issue of humanity, which is self-discovery? Our separation from ourselves, he says. And to me, it's a powerful statement that is relevant even today, but in a different context. Today, the issue is not getting to the moon. Today, the issue is, of course, every year new gadgets come out of Silicon Valley. And we have to realize, you know, the fellow who murdered 50 people at the club in Orlando was on Facebook and texting at the same time he had this machine gun shooting people down. And we know that ISIS gets hold of every gadget the Silicon Valley invents and immediately puts it into their project. So clearly, what Merton talked about in the 60s is true today. Technology is not going to save the human species. Rabbi Heschel said that years ago. He said, humanity will not be saved by more information, but by more appreciation. That's spirituality, folks. appreciation. That doesn't mean information is not useful and important, but it does not get to the bottom line, the problem with our species. Here's how Merton put it. He says, even if we can fly, so what? There are flying ants. Even if humans fly all over the universe, we are still nothing but a flying ant until we recover a human center and a human spirit in the depth of our own being. What can we gain by sailing to the moon if you're not able to cross the abyss that separates us from ourselves? This is the most important of all voyages of discovery, and without it, all the rest are not only useless, but disastrous. So I think in that observation, he is opening up everything we mean by spirituality. This abyss that separates us from ourselves. Now, in the creation spiritual tradition, we talk about the four paths. The four paths name, in an archetypal way, I think, the deep journey that we're all on, however we want to talk about it. So I'm going to name these paths for you. The Via Positiva is the first of the paths. And that is a path of awe and wonder and delight. And it's also the path of reverence and gratitude. Just like Rabbi Heschel says, that gratitude is what is going to open up the human heart. And that's how you go deeper. It's also about the expansion of consciousness. Because joy, Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century said that joy expands the human being. Fear shrinks us, but joy expands us. Aquinas says, God is supremely joyful and therefore supremely conscious. The relationship between joy and consciousness, we don't hear enough about that in a patriarchal culture that we've inherited, but because we've been living through centuries of tremendous pessimism. But I think that precisely at this time when we have to open up our consciousness and with it our imaginations to get things done, we should be paying more attention. Aquinas says joy is a human's noblest act. Well, if joy is a human's noblest act, why don't we build education on joy? Because it would be too revolutionary, perhaps. I'll tell you, I developed alternative models of education 30, 35 years ago for adults, and they've been very successful. But about 5 years ago, I took it to the inner city in Oakland, where I live, for teenagers, because so many inner city teenagers are dropping out of high school. And I found they're dropping out because they're bored and because there's no joy in the learning and all this exam stuff. So I had them doing creativity, making movies, murals, poetry, rap. And after a year of this pilot project, 100% said they wanted to stay in school now. Why? Because they experienced the joy of learning. Duh. You got to begin there. You don't begin with exams. You begin with the joy of learning. In one class, I'll never forget, an 18-year-old fellow, senior in high school, black young man, he said to me, "This is the first time in 4 years of high school that anyone's asked me to express myself creatively." There you have it. Because there's joy in creating, but our priests of education are so busy being bureaucrats that they've lost all sense of the joy of learning, and they're passing it on. So that's just one example of where the Via Positiva has a very important cultural role to play in awakening joy and expanding consciousness. The Via Negativa, and of course this is a little Latin, goes a very long way in our culture, so via is a word for path or way, so this is the negative path. Now this is the way of silence. So the Buddhist tradition, of course, the Quakers and the monastic traditions are very strong on this path, and it's very important that we all learn the value of solitude, the value of silence. And the psalmist says, "Be still and learn that I am God." So the gift of being still, however you are able to tap into that. And of course, we're blessed today with so many practices, east and west, to silence. And that could be yoga, it could be Zen, it can be running, it can be all kinds of ways of, it can be sitting on a cushion. But there are many ways to be silent. It could be just going into nature or unplugging the TV set. But silence is very important. Meister Eckhart says that nothing in all creation is so like God as silence. And that in the experience of silence, we are spoken to. We learn deep listening. So that's part of the via negativa, is the silence. There's also the teaching of the radical mystery of divinity. That it's so easy to get to put God in our pocket, or let's say stamp God on our coins and dollar bills and MX missiles. But the truth is that divinity is radically unnameable. Meister Eckhart says God is super essential darkness who has no name and will never be given a name. And the word for that is the apophatic divinity, the divinity of darkness, not of light. The via positiva is the God of light and creation. The via negativa, the God of darkness, silence. And also, we experience in the via negativa grief and suffering. I was with my last gig in Italy, it was Saturday, was with an amazing community, very alive, 450 people were there. But what they're doing for one another, one of their projects is to deal with parents whose children commit suicide. Now that's radical. For a parent to outlive their children is always a profound, unnameable experience of grief. But to outlive your child who's committed suicide, that's heavy. And this community has attracted such parents. And I met several of them. And they've been profoundly supportive and healing in this process, which, of course, never fully heals itself. But, of course, we're all experiencing so much grief today. That's what the disappearance of species is about. This is what's being triggered in us. We're not naming it. I think our churches and synagogues are doing a lousy job of teaching us grief practices by which to deal. And if we do not deal with our grief, we're not going to have the creativity to solve our problems. Grief is terribly important today. I did a grieving ceremony a few years ago at the Sounds True Conference up in the Rocky Mountains in the summer for 800 people from many, many traditions. And it was very powerful. We took about an hour, and I did this practice that I developed. And afterwards, one guy came up to me, and he said, I've been seeing a psychiatrist for 21 years. He said, I'm firing her on Monday. All I needed was this grief experience. Grief is like a rock in our hearts. And if we can't melt it and let it go, it will control us. And creativity will not flow. And remember, the first level of grief is anger. Often when I see young people showing their anger, my first question is, what are they grieving? And of course, a lot of young people have plenty to grieve today because the planet is clearly on a downward spin. So the work of grief is part of via negativa, very important. Then comes the via creativa, like creativity. And this is so important. In my book on creativity, I point out that this is the working definition of a human being today by anthropologists. They don't just look for our ancestors as bipeds, the bones of a biped. They look for bipeds and artifacts next to the biped. That guarantees that they're our ancestors. Creativity is at the is the working definition, a biped who makes things, that's who we are as a species. And that is what's going to save us, the release of creativity. In India, they've invented a car that runs on air. Well, that seems like a pretty good idea. They're now, of course, getting fuel, non-toxic fuel, from dumps So it's a marvelous way to recycle things and to use the recycling, much better than using fossil fuels and so forth. So what we can do with our imagination and creativity is really just beginning in light of this crisis we're facing as a planet with the carbon dioxide releasing and so forth. So creativity is so central. And, of course, this is what most distinguishes Einstein's universe and the post-Einsteinian universe from Newton's universe, from a modern scientific view of the universe. Newton felt the universe was done, and we had to fit in. But the new story from science is the universe began smaller than a zygote. It's been growing ever since, hundreds of billions of galaxies large, and it's all been created from the get-go. So our creativity is really a mirror of the creativity of the universe. Then we come to the fourth path, the via transformativa, the transformative path. And that's the way of compassion and justice. It's the way of healing and of celebration. And so this is what we use our creativity for, because creativity by itself, of course, can be used for whatever. Creating gas ovens was creative, a way of killing enemies and scapegoats more efficiently. Nuclear bombs and the submarines to deliver, that's creative. Tearing down a rainforest in a day, which we do, that's creative. So creativity itself needs a direction. And the direction, which I think is universal in all the traditions of the world, is compassion and justice. The Dalai Lama says, "We can do away with all religion, but we can't do away with compassion. Compassion is my religion," he says. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Jesus said the same thing in Luke 6. "Be you compassionate as your Creator in heaven is compassionate." And of course, Jesus got that from his Jewish tradition. In the Jewish tradition, compassion is the secret name for God. And in the Quran, by far the most common adjective applied to Allah is Allah, the compassionate one. So there's a universal teaching here that this path four is the culmination of being a human being. This is the imitation of God, if you will, that humans are called to. And the biblical tradition is especially strong in connecting justice and compassion. In fact, the Dalai Lama gave a talk to his Buddhist monks a year or two ago, and he said, "We Buddhists are very good at meditating on compassion and talking about compassion." He said we should imitate the Christians more in practicing compassion. Well, I'm glad he's met some good Christians. Not everyone does. But at least his point is well taken. It's not enough just to meditate on compassion or to talk about it. We have to act as a species. Our contemplation, our what we learn in silence, has to be taken today into action. And so many young people I meet are feeling this profoundly. They want to be contemplative, but they want to be active. The mystic is the lover. The prophet is the warrior. The mystic grows into being the prophet. And the prophet then is not just in an action-reaction response with the reptilian brain. The prophet is developing the mammal brain, which is where compassion is to be found. It's no coincidence that the word for compassion in both Hebrew and Arabic comes of the word for womb. The womb people, that's us, the mammals. We're here to bring more compassion to the planet. But you wouldn't always know it from checking our history out. And this is why we get all these avatars. We get Buddha, we get Jesus, we get Lao Tzu, we get Muhammad, we get Moses. So many, everyone is shouting the same words. Be you compassionate. We don't get that because the reptilian brain wants to dominate. It's 420 million years old, after all. The mammal brain is half that old. So we have to kind of calm the reptilian brain. And how do you do that? By meditation. Reptiles aren't real good at bonding, but they're great at solitude. So by humans getting into our solitude, the via negativa, that's how you calm the reptilian brain. Nice crocodile, nice crocodile. Then our mammal brains, which are our compassionate brains, can go to work. So science really helps us by pointing out that we've got these three brains. It really does. And that's how I understand meditation. It is calming the reptilian brain, because reptiles love to lie alone in the sun. They're great at solitude. So we have to deal with reptile in us by lying alone in the sun, that is to say, by solitude. Then we're ready to ratchet up our creativity and to put it to good use of compassion and justice. So these are a few thoughts, and I know that we want to have a discussion, but these are a few ways by which I name the creation spiritual journey. I find it very archetypal. It's not just about our so-called religious lives. To me, this applies to musicians. We had a course in our university, for example, where a musician who was very in love with music, he would teach courses on Mozart as a spiritual director, or Mahler as a spiritual director, or so forth. And he would take the four paths. He would play the music and would show how here Mahler is speaking to the via positiva, or here he's speaking to the via negativa, and so on. And it's a way of honoring what I would call the yoga of the West. Our musicians and our artists and our science in the West is in many ways a yoga. It is a way of going deeper into nature, including our own nature. But few people have had the language to really pull out what's there in terms of the profound spiritual gifting that we've been blessed with by so many great souls, some of whom are like Thomas Merton. You might say more in the religious business because he's a monk, but many of whom, scientists, artists, musicians, and so many more, activists, have been playing out these four paths in their work and in their lives. So they are creation-centered mystics as well. So I think it's time now for some discussion, and I'm open to hearing questions or comments.
Now we'll have some questions from the audience, and we'll have a microphone that goes around. So just step up to the mic and ask away.
Okay. Addressing number three, the via creativa, and where we are as a species, based on the thoughts of Richard Florida and his ideas of growing creativity within humanity, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't know that particular individual, but I'm all for growing creativity in humanity. Okay. And I wrote my own book on creativity to take that subject up. But also, there's wonderful teachings from our mystics. For example, Thomas Aquinas says, the same spirit that hovered over the waters at the beginning of creation hovers over the mind of the artist at work. That's just beautiful telling of the co-creation that we do. That creation is not something that happened in the past. It's still going on. It's continuous. And we're definitely a part of it, that the great spirit, the great mind, the great artist, what Aquinas called the artist of artists, that's his one of his words for God, images of God, is with us still. And when I talk about artist, I'm not just talking about someone who paints or dances or puts on theater or makes film. We're all artists. Think about raising your children. It's an art form. It's not a science. Think about balancing a checkbook. I think that's an art form. conversation is an art form. Cooking a meal, decorating your house. I mean, think about, we're artists all day long. Modern consciousness has cut us off from this reality, but pre-modern consciousness, among indigenous people, for example, but also the medieval thinkers, in many Native American languages, there's no word for artist. Why? Because everybody's an artist. Why do you have to name it? There's no word for religion either. Because making beauty, they feel, is what we're all here to do. Naturally. Organically. One Native American, David Paladin, who was also a major painter, he said, I'm sick and tired of hearing white people tell me they're not artists. If you can talk, you're an artist. You're translating your feelings and your thoughts into language. That is an art form. So then you go back to Aquinas' point. The great spirit is working with us whenever we're we're being artists, that means we're co-creating all day long.
Okay, I totally agree with what you're saying, but I also look at a dip in human history at the onset of the Industrial Revolution, when it did not benefit the Industrial Revolution to have people be creative. They needed to be cogs. They needed to be cogs for the system to work. And
right.
And it appears, from what I'm seeing, that we're kind of fighting to get beyond that.
Oh, definitely. A lot of young people are dropping out of our work world as it's currently defined because they feel called to do a more creative thing than you're allowed to do, including I've met many teachers who are quitting teaching because they're not allowed to be creative teachers anymore. They're so frustrated by it all. And so you have this split again that's happening, but it's the beginning of something new. We're leaving behind an old paradigm full of dinosaurs. I mean, anyone who thinks that our economic system, political system, religious systems, media systems are doing well today, you know, I would like to have a conversation on that. I see them all collapsing before our eyes, melting like the ice in Greenland. Mm-hmm. And more people are waking up, and they're falling back on creativity. And we have to create new forms of doing education, of doing worship, of doing economics and politics. And that is a radical invitation to creativity. I think we're moving beyond the mechanistic world of modern age and industrialization. The world is no longer seen as a machine. And yet we really haven't caught up with that in terms of our important institutions, including and especially education.
I think spirituality helps us be grounded where we are today, and I guess I'm living in the via confusita. How do you see this all functioning? I mean, you just look at what's happening around us. It's not just here in this country.
No.
It's in England. It's all of these different sorts of forces at play in view of what you're looking at here. I just was interested how you kind of put your spirituality to work in what we're experiencing every day when we watch CNN or something like that.
Well, your path of confusion is the part of the via negativa. The mystics call it the dark night of the soul, and that's confusion with a capital C. I think today as a species we're in a collective dark night of our species. But what the mystics teach about the dark night is that it's a very valuable place to be, that you learn things there in the dark you don't learn elsewhere. And because I say we're in a dark night of our species because we don't know how this is going to end. We don't know if our species is going to survive and if we have what it takes to pull us out of this free fall that we're in. So this is why spirituality is important, I think. It builds the courage and the grounding to stay centered. There's a marvelous teaching from Hafiz, the 14th century Sufi mystic. He came right after Rumi. He says, sometimes God wants to do us a great favor. Turn us upside down and shake all the nonsense out. But most people I know, when they hear God is in such a playful, drunken mood, quickly pack their bags and hightail it out of town. That's the confusion moment that you've named. We are in this moment of being upside down and shaking all the nonsense out. And there's a lot of nonsense that's coming out. And our first instinct is to pack our bags and hightail it out of town. But it's spirituality that has you stick around for the dark night. It gives you the courage to know that if we're going to pull out of this, we've got to keep our eyes open. We've got to remain centered in the now. We have to deal with what Hafiz calls the hooves of the past, as well as the ghosts of the future, which, of course, is fear. All fear is about the future. So we have these politicians today, well, ever since 9/11, the politicians and the media have been making great amounts of money by selling fear, pitching fear. And But all this is an invitation to stay grounded and centered, and that's what spirituality helps us to do. And again, this is ancient teaching. It comes from the Sufi tradition as well as from other traditions. So I think that's part of the time in which we're living.
As I see spirituality, it's been heavily focused on what I call individualized religion, kind of every person for themselves. And the question is, what forms of organized religion or spirituality do you see the bridge, what I'll call the communal aspects that religion has formed, as opposed to the individualistic aspects that spirituality seems to have fostered?
Well, of course, I'm 100% against that individualized spirituality. Creation spirituality, by its very name, is about our kinship with creation. Is anything but individual. It's the modern era that individualized us overly much. But the pre-modern era, whether you're talking Native American, remember the phrase of the Lakota people every time they pray, Ahomatakiasi, all our relations, is at the very heart. That's their most sacred prayer, and it's repeated whenever they pray. So cosmology, all our relations, is at the heart of any healthy spirituality. Now, today's science is giving us a new cosmology, in fact, a new creation story. And it's wonderful to be told that we have been on a journey for 13.8 billion years. It explains why we need a nap once in a while. And that we're that if you run the movie of the universe backwards, we all come from the same original fireball. And we all contain the same elements. By we, I mean us and galaxies and the sun and the planets and the trees and the animals and the fishes and one another. So this is about waking up our communitarian brain again, if you will. But again, do not think spiritual has always been individualistic. That is a modern consciousness. Your pre-moderns, including the this is why I love the medieval mystics so much, Hildegard, Aquinas. Aquinas says, every human being is capax universi, capable of the universe. Well, now we're being told by science how marvelous the universe is, how old it is, how it's still creating, still expanding. It's just awesome to know that we're part of that universe. So pre-modern thinkers, whether indigenous or medieval, were not into this individualistic thing that happened through history, and with a part of it being capitalism and industrialism and the rest. No, this is part of what's breaking down now, that all things are interdependent. Now, not only is science finally saying that again, but these words are the exact words of Hildegard of Bingen, of Meister Eckhart, and of others in the pre-modern consciousness. We are in this together. The basis of reality is interdependence. And this is also the meaning of compassion. Compassion comes out of a physics, actually, the physics of interdependence. We now have a physics that can launch an era of compassion, because compassion, as Thomas Merton defined compassion 3 hours before he died in a talk he gave in Bangkok. And he said that compassion is a keen awareness of the interdependence of all living things that are all part of one another and involved in one another. So part of compassion is shared joy, and part of compassion is the shared suffering that we try to do something to relieve through our works of justice and healing. So that's about interdependence. And you, to the extent that religion or spirituality is individualistic, it will never get to path four. It'll never get to compassion and justice. But we have so many heroes and heroines, the launchers of the labor movement, for example, and so many others, many of whom lost their life. And, of course, the civil rights movement, so many of the women's movement, the gay movement. All this is about the playing out of a spirituality of interdependence, that we're in this together. And I think that's a dynamic of history. Are we going to be just stuck on our individualistic survival, or are we going to realize we all rise, or none of us rises?
Hi. I think this this question is along the lines of your first principle, the via positiva. And it was something said by a man by the name of Larry Brilliant when I was listening to a podcast the other day. This guy involved in the eradication of smallpox. And what he said, which I think is based on Hindu principles, he said, see God in everyone, in everything. And it was something that struck me as particularly intriguing because it did bring about this awe-type or compassionate-type mindset. And when I kind of tried to meditate on that thought throughout the course of a day, I saw a significant improvement on my day because I did feel compassion, whereas other things were, you know, seeing it in other lights or different scenarios in another light, it brought about anxiety and fear, say. Is there a way that you would recommend for meditating, not meditation, but say when you're living and you're doing your job day to day, something is there a way that you would recommend meditating on a thought that you could exercise while going about your day consciously?
Sure.
Such as that.
Well, that's a very important observation. Thomas Merton has this great question he asked after he had this mystical experience in the streets of Louisville at rush hour. He said, how is it possible to tell everyone that they're walking around shining like the sun, S-U-N? You see, so you kind of want to think about that, meditate on that. How is everyone shining like the sun? And the fact is that, again, today's science is telling us that there are photons in all beings. We're all light beings. Photons are light waves. And every plant, today, you don't have to go to Sinai and take off your feet or take off your shoes to experience God as a burning bush. Science now tells us every bush is burning and every human being is burning because we're walking around carrying this light inside of us. And then you have these traditions in Christianity that Christ is light in all beings, or in Buddhism you carry the light within you. Every being is carrying the light within them. So getting to know your fellow workers at that level is a very powerful thing. I've written a book called The Reinvention of Work, and I apply these four paths to work itself. And it's an ecumenical work. That is to say, I examined what all spiritual traditions of the world say about work, and they all agree on some really basic things. And number one is joy. The Tao Te Ching says, in work, do what you enjoy. And this is common to all the spiritual teaching about work. So the number one question I think to ask at work is this. In what way are we experiencing joy in our work? And in what way is our work bringing joy to others? To me, those are the two most radical questions about work. And if you can't answer them from your workplace, then you're not at work. You're in a job. And that's okay, too. We need jobs to pay the bills. But know the difference between job and work. Real work is about joy, your own and the sharing of it. And then how can we up the ante on joy where we work? How can there be more joy instead of less? So those are a few practices.
Yes, hello. I confess to being spiritually disabled. I mean, for example, I'm a lawyer by training, so Lord help me. But I agree totally with the focus on compassion and justice. I think that's great. My problem is I get hung up in thinking about the enemies out there, the bad guys out there, whoever that may be. You know, sport ute drivers, you know, the chairman of Wells Fargo, NRA members, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, what have you learned in your spiritual practice? How could I develop a better attitude about the bad guys that have to be dealt with in order to make advances? Koch brothers come to mind.
Well, being spiritual is not about being naive. You don't want to leave out the shadow, including one's own or one's own profession, which you began with an honest confession there. So to realize that evil is not just out there, we can all participate in it. You know, Hitler, you know, was voted in. He didn't drop down as a dictator because he articulated the resentment of the Germans of the 1930s with the loss of the war, with the bad armistice deal, and, of course, with the Depression. And so he called on this resentment, as some of today's politicians are still very capable of doing. So we want to realize that evil is not this strange thing. It doesn't go walking around with a sign on its back saying, I'm evil, kick me. Evil is very, very smart. And it goes to where the power places are. It doesn't bother itself with places of little power. It goes where the power is. And so we have to be very careful of our complicity in evil. And actually, I have a new book out on evil. It's called Sins of the Spirit, Blessings of the Flesh. It's a foreword by Deepak Chopra. And in his foreword, his second paragraph, he says, this is the number one issue in spirituality today. He said, millions of people are leaving organized religion. The world is not becoming less evil. So we've got to start wrestling with this stuff. Now, what I do in that book is I come up with a new language for talking about evil, because I think religion has done such a bad job of overselling sin that we have left out evil. We've so trivialized evil, calling it sin. So I spent years trying to figure out, is there a new language for dealing with evil? And what I came up with is this. It's an east-west combination. Taking the seven chakras of the east and comparing it to the seven capital sins of the West. Because if a chakra is a naming of power points, if you will, love centers in all of ourselves, psyche and physiologically, then sin would be a misdirected love. That's how Aquinas defines it. So it would be an off-center chakra. So let me give you an example. The seventh chakra is, of course, the culminating chakra here in our crown and our head. And so the kundalini energy passes through the other six chakras, and the fire builds up and up. And then when we're in a healthy state, it shoots out, and it links up with other light beings to work together, like other good lawyers working for real justice, for example, maybe, and with ancestors and with angels, the light beings that are spiritual and not material. That's a healthy seventh chakra. But an unhealthy seventh chakra would be envy. Envy recognizes the good in others, just like a healthy chakra does. But it doesn't want to link up with the others. It wants to shoot them down. Envy really becomes a basis of war and lies and all kinds of calumny and so forth. So that's just one example of how the West naming of envy corresponds to the East naming of the seven chakra. And I go through all the chakras like that. And I think it really works. And I think it, in the process, we're coming up with a new language by which to talk about evil. And I think we need that. That psychologist, Scott Peck, he said that our language for evil today is at just a primitive stage. And that one line had something to do with my working on this study. Can we come up with a language that is more sophisticated and fresh than what we've been dealing with? And I think that's one way to go. There's a woman here who wanted to ask a question. She was hidden by the pillar. Yeah.
Could you comment on, there's been a lot of talk recently about the importance of Sabbath and the fact that as a culture, we've moved away from the honoring of the Sabbath, the palace in time, as Herschel, is that his name?
Heschel
calls it. And that, there's even a theory that a lot of the anxiety we see among young children and, in the teenage years and stuff is because they don't have a Sabbath. Mm. What's your opinion about that? Yeah. Because it's very important, Christianity, Judaism, mm-hmm. Islam. Mm-hmm. Or do you see that there's something to that, or do you think they're co-opting an old idea inappropriately?
Hmm. Well, I think there's a lot to that. I think, remember, the Sabbath is meant to be a rest, not just for busy parents, but even for the soil and for the farm animals, that everyone should have some time off. So it is an affront to rabid capitalism. And this idea that 24/7 you have to be proving your existence by making more money or whatnot. I think that's the archetype behind the Sabbath. I would put it at the level of celebration of path four. You see, the via transformativa and the via positiva. Because these paths, the image I have for it is a spiral. That, you know, it doesn't stop with four, then you advance, you expand the spiral, and it goes back to the via positiva. Justice is not an end in itself. Purpose of justice is to bring more people to the banquet of life, the via positiva. And so, to me, Sabbath, in its deepest sense, is the celebration of life. And it involves both the first and the fourth. Well, it involves all these paths, really. But that is missing. I think the celebration of life is getting short shrift in a culture where, say, two parents have to work, and you know, everything is so stressful. Sabbath is the opposite of stress. So meditation is a Sabbath too, taking time off from thinking. Taking time off from worrying. You might, and of course, creativity is part of that. So really, now that you ask the question, I think all four of these paths feed us some information about Sabbath. But I would not recommend getting overly literal about Sabbath. I think it's an archetype about honoring our need for rest and repose and refreshment. Eckhart has a whole sermon on repose. He says everything in creation is meant to repose, and that's where we lie down with God, if you will, or the walking in the garden with God and so forth. You know, we have so many images, and even the idea of the garden is an archetype of celebration and repose and being blessed. Not just doing all the blessing, receiving, you see. Yeah. There's a marvelous line in Baudelaire, the 19th century French art critic, who says, we walk through forests, plural, forests of physical things that are also spiritual things that look on us with affectionate looks. We are being blessed by the universe on a daily basis, the sun, the moon, the soil, the animals, the air, all of it. But we don't, Sabbath is to acknowledge that. The essence of Sabbath is to say thank you. Thomas Aquinas is really big on that. The primary purpose of Sabbath is thank you, gratitude. And are we shortchanging that? Yes. Or as Rabbi Heschel puts it, praise precedes faith, he says. It's a wonderful line. Praise precedes faith. Have we lost our capacity to praise? I know this woman, Jill Pierce, who's the wife of Rupert Sheldrake, the British scientist who I've written a couple of books with. And Jill does these marvelous Tibetan workshops with Tibetan sound. She can do things with her throat you can't believe can be done. And I remember I went to one of her workshops. She opened up by saying, you know, this is all about praise. But in the West, we've forgotten how to praise. We've forgotten that we're here to praise. Well, that's what the Via Positiva is all about. And that's what the Sabbath is about, praise and gratitude and getting off the busy squirrel cage, out of the squirrel cage, yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
I feel like a lot of the creativity that I see today when I look around me is about... it seems to spark off adversity or maintaining an unjust status quo or quarterly results or something that kills. Or I feel like there's a lot of creativity that doesn't serve us well. And when there is sort of like a blip of that, it's wonderful to enjoy it for a moment, but then there's that feeling of the inevitable, now let's return to our regular programming. So I don't know if you agree, but I mean, if you do, what does it take for us as a species to harness the creativity that we have and have it serve something positive or to come from a positive place?
Yeah. Well, sometimes it takes a crisis. What do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention. And I like to think of the story that I was taught by a physicist about when humans left Africa about 60,000 years ago, and we had discovered fire, and we wandered in our curiosity, and we ended up with what today would be Eurasia, and the Ice Age broke out. For 10,000 years, there is an Ice Age. Now, we've just come from the savannas of Africa. I'm sure we spent the first 1,000 years asking who turned off the heat. But meanwhile, we had a hustle. We had to learn how to kill a woolly mammoth and skin it, how to hide in caves and make stories around the fire and stay warm and all the rest, and how to grow a meager amount of food to survive. These are our ancestors. We don't come from weak stock. These people were tough, and they were creative. They had to completely reinvent their lives overnight, practically, with no telephone book, no internet, nothing like that. It's amazing. This is a stock from which we come. And so if we can get out of denial about things like climate change, here we have a whole political party in denial. Several months ago, I was invited to be part of a conference on climate change in Florida. At the time, Florida had two presidential candidates and a governor who were, all three of them were committed to denial of climate change. And here, the conference began with the scientist who got up and showed slides of Florida. Today, 10 years from today, 30 years from today, my lesson is don't buy land in Florida. Chop, chop, chop. 40 years, and there was no Florida left. And then their three biggest political figures are in denial. So everyone was so depressed, and then it was my turn to talk. So I got up and I talked about the power of denial, that our capacity for denial has no end. But the good news is, Meister Eckhart says, God is the denial of denial. So in other words, if we're living in denial, divinity is nowhere to be seen, because divinity has something to do with truth, and denial doesn't. Denial is a deliberate effort to remain stupid. And Aquinas says that's a mortal sin. He says to choose to be ignorant of something that is important is a mortal sin, meaning a deadly virus that you spread in yourself and your community. So we have to address denial. And so I do think that your question is right on. As I said earlier, we're at this point where either we awaken creativity like never before, maybe the nearest analogy is that moment when our ancestors moved from thinking the world was warm to experiencing the Ice Age for 10,000 years, and they survived generation after generation. So let's not have the luxury of feeling sorry for ourselves or wallowing in despondency or despair. We have to shake ourselves up and get to work. And everyone, every age, from 7 to 77, has to contribute. We need all hands on deck. But creativity, I think, is at the heart of it. But the point you're making is, by itself, creativity is not enough. There are a lot of creative people who are trying to keep the hatches down. That's why the Via Transformativa is so important. It's creativity for healing, for justice, for the truth, and for future generations. It's not creativity for a small group, well, we call them 1%, who are doing very well in the current circumstances. That cage has to be rattled and shouted about at every level.
Hey, we are grateful and thankful to Dr. Fox for being with us today. We're also thankful to our audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 113th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.